This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and I'm joined in studio today by our new U.S. Senator for North Dakota, Heidi Heitkamp. Good to have you with us today.
Hey, Doug. It's good to be here.
Well, you have taken up residence in the nation's capital.
And, oh, no, I have not.
Oh, you haven't? No. You don't have a place you stay there?
Well, I do, but it's not my residence.
Okay, got you. Yeah. You're a North Dakota resident. That's an important word for a politician, isn't it?
Not only that, but, you know, the day I start feeling like that's my home, that's the day I'm quitting this, moving home.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some current affairs in that other place you visit.
I work in.
Budgets. We have competing budgets now. Once again, we've got the Senate budget proposal and the Ryan budget out of the House, and they're quite different, but is there some hope?
Well, I think the first thing to understand is what was released were the chairman's, both Congressman Ryan and Senator Murray released their version of the budget. Senator Murray just conducted, I think, what looked like about a 10-hour hearing of the Budget Committee considering a number of amendments. Not sure how many of them passed. So we don't have a recommendation from the Budget Committee yet. That's probably going to happen sometime next week. Then any senator can also introduce amendments on the floor of the Senate as well. But before that gets done, what we have to do is we have to finish the funding for fiscal year 13, which is the fiscal year we're in. And so when people hear a discussion about the CR, the continuing resolution, all that is funding the government from March at a certain point all the way through the end of September. That's the current debate on the floor of the Senate. I think they were hoping to get that done this week. We voted on a couple amendments, and then they're trying to control the number of amendments that are currently pending on the continuing resolution are 99.
Oh, boy.
And I think we're going to see that many amendments on the budget as well. And you might ask, why this seems really dysfunctional, and it is. And the reason why it's dysfunctional is because this is not the process that really has been established for years and years, that has worked for years and years to run the United States Senate. And as a result, members who aren't on those committees or maybe in leadership feel like they aren't getting their voice heard, and the only way to raise issues is in this fashion. Hopefully, you'll hear in the news about they want to get back to regular order. Regular order is just doing the things that you see North Dakota doing in their legislature. The Senate considers, the House considers, they go to conference, they work it out, they resolve their and they send it on to the governor. The governor signs or vetoes, and they move on with life.
And they this do it is in 80 days.
Yes, it's wonderful. Well, some people might not think it's all wonderful in Bismarck, but at least the process achieves results. And I think I'm not someone who comes and talks about process much, but I'm hopeful that we will get back to a process where we can deliberate and consider the very important issues confronting this country in a adult-like fashion rather than this kind of made-up crisis.
Well, in the meantime, we're 2 weeks into sequestration. So yeah. What's your take on that, and how is it ultimately going to affect North Dakota?
Well, I think you're going to see more and more impacts of sequestration. One place where I'm concerned in particular is in the amounts of money that would be otherwise allocated or appropriated to the Indian reservations. Why is that important? Because funding BIA policemen, funding tribal policemen is pretty darned important to protecting families and women and children, funding education, doing the things that we need to do. We've got a Title I problem that's going to hit. We've got impact aid that's going to hit our regular institutions of higher or of learning. We've got some research grants that could have a pretty dramatic effect on our research institutions. You know, having this work for 4 years where we're in the middle of a 5-year grant to study and then all of a sudden getting it cut off at the last year doesn't make a lot of sense. I said this during the campaign and I'll say it again. This sequestration is a institution-made problem. This is not something the Constitution requires people to do. It is absolutely the wrong way to reduce budgets. The budgets need to be reduced strategically rather than, you know, across the board cuts. And it certainly is going to have an impact on the military.
Is there any way sequestration can be undone except with a budget?
No. And the budget won't undo the sequestration, ironically.
Well, it's already happening.
There'll be some effects of the sequestration that I think will be mitigated in the continuing resolution that's going to be considered and probably, you know, agreed to by both sides. But sequestration represents a real frustration, I think, on everyone's part that we haven't been able to do the things that the American public expects us to do, which is to get our fiscal house in order, one way or the other, to actually debate the various budgets and let the appropriations committees do what they're supposed to be doing. So hopefully when we get out of this cycle of this fiscal year, we'll be able to do things in a proper and correct way for 2014. Sequestration hits, you know, you'll hear people say, well, what's 2.4%? And what I will tell you is that, number one, there were a number of budgets rightfully exempted, one of which was military pay and military benefits. Some veterans' benefits were exempted from sequestration. That's 40% of DOD's budget. Then what you're doing is you're taking these cuts on a time period that's much shorter than a whole fiscal year, because that was delayed at the end of the year when the Congress made their final resolutions on New Year's Eve. And so very, very kind of convoluted way to run the government, and it needs to stop, and we need to step back. But do we need to reduce budgets? Absolutely. We cannot continue to spend money that we don't have, and I would argue in some cases on things we don't need.
Well, Social Security is somehow tied into this whole argument, even though it is supposed to be funding itself. Where do you stand on sort of reorganizing Social Security?
Well, I think that as it relates to entitlement programs, Social Security is the least emergent. By that I mean it's not an emergency yet.
It's not like Medicare, Medicaid.
No, Medicare without the Affordable Care Act, Medicare was given 7 additional years of solvency through the Affordable Care Act. So 7 years isn't a long time.
No.
I mean, you know, Doug, it was when we were in high school. It seemed like forever. But at our age, it's not a long time anymore, that 7 years. And so people who say you can do it all without looking at entitlements, they're wrong. And I'll just say that up front. So what are some of the solutions? I don't think that we've, because it's gotten to be such a hard political issue, I don't think that we've heard all of the creative ways that we could be doing things better. I sit on a committee called Homeland Security. But what's important about the Homeland Security Committee is that it also does government oversight. We think that there is probably $700 billion of fraud, waste, and abuse in the Medicare system. If we did it, we could actually go a long way towards solving some of the problems. And I think we're going to hold hearings on that, talk about what we need to do. Obviously, in North Dakota, our big concern with Medicare funding is that we not lose the Frontier States Amendment, which is an equalization of Medicare payments. And so I'm watching all of these amendments very carefully. Senator Cruz's amendment that would have stopped the funding of the Health Care Reform Act or Affordable Care Act would have actually stopped the funding for the Frontier States Amendment. That's why I vote against it.
Well, let's talk now about another bill that's of critical importance to North Dakota and Minnesota. That's the Farm Bill. That's been mired in Washington quicksand, too. Mm-hmm. What are its prospects?
Well, before we get there, I'd just like to mention that there has been some saber rattling on the sugar program in these budget amendments. So not even looking at a Farm Bill, but some people trying to take a run at the sugar program in Congress during this continuing resolution process. We're fighting those back pretty firmly, doing everything that we can to make sure that that everybody recognizes that's the wrong place for that discussion. The Farm Bill has been delayed. First off, we should have had a Farm Bill last year. Had we had a Farm Bill last year, we would be in a lot better position right now. Last year's Farm Bill, 2012, as it passed the Senate, it scored a $23 billion score. What does that mean? It's like for those of us who have worked in North Dakota legislature, it's your fiscal note. What's it cost to do this? And what we thought was the savings were $23 billion. You know, that we would save from the previous farm program. Now that score is actually down to 13. So it's a little more challenging to reach the $23 billion target. The House has set a target in the Ryan budget. They haven't finalized the Ryan budget yet. But the Ryan budget's target for the farm bill, including nutrition, is actually $120 billion. So there's a pretty big distance there. But we're gonna work through these things. And people say, why are you so optimistic about the farm bill? I tell them because I know Debbie Stabenow, the chair of the farm committee, the ag committee, and she is absolutely determined. She's an incredible leader. She is a compromiser. She tries to accommodate everyone's concerns, and I know that she'll do a great job. And I think that Congressman Peterson, along with Congressman Lucas over in the House, has the same sense of urgency for the farm bill, and I'm hoping that we can get this in conference sometime yet this spring.
What about the makeup of Congress in terms of agricultural issues? Is it becoming more urban, less tied to the land?
Well, it sure is. I mean, you know, I always tell people that you need to remember that every senator has a farmer in their district. But not every congressman has a farmer in his or her district.
Ah, yes.
And so some people would say, in fact, that the makeup of the United States House of Representatives, the farm makeup, is really only about 10-15%. And so it makes this farm bill challenging. But I have friends who remind me, and I remind everybody likes to eat. And making sure that we have a farm program that guarantees a safe and reliable source of food for our country is a pretty critical national security issue, as well as an issue that I think involves the sustenance of what we do to exist. And we just need to make sure that we are, in fact, telling everyone in the United States Congress that this should be everyone's concern.
Hmm. Well, the story that got a lot of attention in North Dakota a couple days ago, and I think people are still talking about, is your proposal to count everybody again.
Anyone who, certainly those of us who live out west, but even looking at Fargo-Moorhead, who thinks that the last census that was done is correct, doesn't know how to count.
I think the mayor had a disagreement about that number, yes.
And so this is critically important that we count everyone, because it really does determine a lot of public policy. A lot of what should happen for North Dakota is important for our federal programs, that we understand what the needs are and what our population is. And so we'd really like to see the state, fork over a few bucks and actually pay for a new census.
Now, census does cost some money, yep. But you're saying there's a real cost benefit here.
Absolutely. And I think that anyone out west would tell you, any of the public officials out west would tell you that it will be well worth the dollars if we actually renew our quest to discover how many people actually live in North Dakota. Plus, I just want to brag to Thune and Johnson that we're bigger than South Dakota, and I know that's coming any day.
All right. Well, North Dakota's newest U.S. Senator, Heidi Heitkamp, is with us in studio. We'll have more with our discussion about what's happening out east and what's happening in North Dakota in just a moment.
It's a night of jazz on Prairie Public. Following the rebroadcast of Main Street, we kick it off with Friday Night Swing with Lloyd Anderson. Then at 9 Central, it's Riverwalk Jazz. And at 10, Bob Studebaker hosts as we present both classic jazz from the legends of American music and new jazz from emerging artists. At 11, it's the Jazz Junket with Ryan Schweitzer, followed at midnight by Jim Wilkie's Jazz After Hours. That's all right here, statewide, on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. In the background, the Auslan Daily Jazz Tet from their CD, The Mendoza Line. All right, a little jazz to promote jazz on TV as well and radio. Well, Heidi Heitkamp is with us, and she is talking about, well, being almost 3 months into her first term, her first six-year term as senator. Well, at least her term as senator. We'll see whether it's her first or whatever it is. But let's talk a bit about the nature of the beast that is Washington, D.C. We see these things going on where we've got these angry marches to the microphone every day from the House leader, John Boehner, from the Senate leader, Harry Reid, occasionally the president's spokesperson. And there's an awful lot of rhetoric flying around, but not much activity. So what's your take?
There is a lot more collegiality than what you might think. Actually.
So that's for us, huh?
Yeah. I think so. I think that I frequently say that if we could just find leadership that cared more about the long-term interest of the people and less about winning a 24-hour news cycle, we could do a lot better. Everybody needs to ratchet this stuff down. They need to, speak respectfully. They need to say, yes, we have disagreements. How about we work through them in an orderly fashion? Let's get decisions made. And I think that way too often, how you're judged as a leader is whether you're winning the media war, where you're winning the 24-hour news cycle, and how you ought to be judged as a leader is whether we're actually getting results. And so in the good news category there is that a lot of people always ask me about term limits in the United States Senate. Should we have term limits? And for those who are curious, over half of the United States Senate has only been there 6 years or less.
That's
six
a term
years
limit.
And a couple months.
Yeah.
And now we see major retirements with Lautenberg, Harkin, Jay Rockefeller, Carl Levin, Mike Johanns, Saxby Chambliss, all. I mean, there you've got seven right away who are all very senior in the Senate who are leaving, except for Johanns. But all five very senior members who are now leaving. So that they're going to be replaced by people who will push this seniority up even higher. Now, why is that important for the institution? I think it's because, the people who are there a long time kind of say, well, we do it this way because we do it this way. And when new people come in and take a look and say, we don't get why you're doing it this way, it doesn't look like it's progress to us. I think the more that those voices become the majority voice, I think the more likely we are to really be able to move the country forward.
Does that also mitigate North Dakota's position as a pretty junior delegation?
I think it does. But remember this, it's not just North Dakota. Hawaii had one of the most senior delegations. Now they have an even more junior delegation than North Dakota. You take a look at I think Minnesota is only senior by, a couple years. And so a lot of the states that have had very senior delegations no longer do because of retirements. That's not to say that Kent Conrad and Byron Dorgan, who are our, team in the United States Senate, were incredibly powerful. And you will hear that over and over again. I'm not saying that wasn't critically important, but time marches on. And hopefully we're building seniority and building relationships. Senator Hoeven and I have regular discussions about things that are important to North Dakota. People know that, that we're going to hang together on those things that are critical to our state. And so that cooperation and collaboration can make up for the lack of seniority as well.
I was a fly on the wall many years ago in the office of Quentin Burdick, and Senator Milton Young was there, and then Congressman Mark Andrews. They were talking about garrison diversion. It was quite obvious that the North Dakota delegation, different parties, some different beliefs, was very solid on some stuff. So yeah. Is the North Dakota delegation solid in 2013?
Oh, absolutely. I think you take a look at on water issues, take a look at on land use issues, energy issues. You see a lot of working back and forth. I just can't say enough good things about how welcoming Senator Hovind's been, and what a great leader he's been on issues like Keystone. Been able to work with him on those. He's already been out front on a lot of important energy issues. And so, we're working together, and I think hopefully we'll be able to achieve good results for the people of North Dakota and for the country.
You talked about Keystone. Of course, the oil patch in North Dakota is pumping money out of the ground, literally, mm-hmm. For the state. It's become the most significant economic circumstance I think the state's ever faced. All this money that is suddenly available. So when should the actual development be moderated, or should it keep going unbridled?
I think the development is already being moderated. What do I mean by that? I think that we will not see the level of drilling that we saw a couple years ago. And I'll tell you why. Because in oil and gas law, you write a lease. A lot of people didn't realize how big this play was. You go out and you negotiate the lease. Maybe you have an eighth royalty. And you have to perfect the lease. And how you perfect the lease is you actually drill on the lease. And so there were a lot of old leases that needed to be perfected that really drove up the need to drill. And so now you see those old leases that have already been perfected, and you see the price of drilling come down. And you heard that. Harold Hamm talked about how, we need to, there was a little bit of price gouging from the guys who were actually drilling the rig, but it was costing more because everything costs more when you have a big a need. Supply and demand curves actually do work occasionally. And so now that we've gotten there, you see a leveling off of the number of rigs. Plus, we're being more efficient with the rigs that are there. They're drilling. Efficiency has improved. Picking up the rigs and moving them, it's incredible what they can do with the platforms. And so the technology just gets better to do more within one site. The technology just gets better for moving the rigs. And I think there's no reason to assume that we can't manage what there currently is.
Well, we're looking at maybe six times as many actual wells in a not too many years. The need to get the oil out of the state as well. The Keystone Pipeline, you've been an ardent supporter of it. Now, technically, it really isn't designed to move oil from North Dakota.
Well, except it will. We think Governor Schweitzer in Montana was very astute in demanding that there be an on-ramp, and that on-ramp is in Baker. And I think there's some sense from the Canadians that, yes, in fact, it will move Bakken. But the better development, or not better, I shouldn't say, but the interesting development has really been the diversity of markets that we can access because we're moving things on rail. And I think Burlington Northern has been responsive to the need. I think they love the new business, and I think that a lot of the companies love to be able to ship their oil east to Delaware so it can be refined in the Delaware refinery. I think they love looking at sending it west to Seattle where it can be refined in the Tesoro refinery there, or shipping it south. And so that's one thing that rail shipping does give us. And you've seen that price differential that we've talked about for years and years. I've been around the oil and gas industry really since 1980. And, we've always been concerned about that price differential. You see it narrowing more and more.
Well, on the other end of this, oil is sequestered carbon. Mm-hmm. Just use that word again. So every time you take it out of the ground and use it, you are obviously putting something into the air or into the environment. So is there something that needs to be done on the regulatory side?
Well, I get what you're saying, but the reality is that Bakken oil is displacing foreign oil in our economy. And let me tell you, that's a really good thing for our foreign policy. It's a really good thing for the economy of this country that we reduce our trade deficit by not having to import as much foreign oil. We truly can be energy independent. Now, I'm a big believer in an energy policy that is all of the above, not just fossil fuels. But I am not someone who is going to sit here and say we can, in fact, run this economy without fossil fuels. We can't. and we have to be realistic. And I think that there's a number of developments, that particularly in the coal area, that are really encouraging in terms of sequestering, as you would put it, the carbon. We're already doing that at Dakota Gas, where we take our CO2, compress it, and it's used in enhanced oil recovery. The interesting thing about North Dakota is that we have both of those sources here.
All right. Well, thank you very much for spending some of your day with us at Prairie Public, Senator Heidi Heitkamp. In town, I think, for many things, but also the St. Patrick's Day Parade
it's
tomorrow in Fargo.
It's going to be fun. And, Doug, if you chicken out, and if you're chicken out because it's too cold, I'm going to laugh at you.
Oh, I always have a warm place on the curb, and I know where the door is to get inside and get really warm. So thanks for joining us today.
I'll walk fast so you won't be out there so long.
Okay, take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Time now for the news with Todd McDonald. And, Todd, you've got some oil news as well.
Yeah, that's right, Doug. Oil production in North Dakota dropped in January as we see more of a seasonable winter, I'm guessing. But compared to with December, officials from the Mineral Resources Department say that January production was 738,000 barrels per day. In December, it was 770,000 barrels per day. Mineral Resources Director Lynn Helms says in January, winter storms and cold weather hampered production. He says trucks are being used to haul oil to rail and loading facilities, and sometimes the trucks couldn't get through. He says the state is into a sawtooth pattern with the weather.
February probably will be a good month, although it was cold early in the month, but then we had some very nice weather as February wore on. But as you know, already in March, we've had a couple of storms and more on the way.
And Helm says after that, some of the counties in the Williston Basin will be putting temporary load restrictions on the roadways.
Mostly we have been hearing from Williams County, but they've already expressed that they, during a short period at least, when spring thaw comes, they may drop things down to below a 10-ton load limit, which basically means we won't even move oil for a short period of time. Their whole point is that the damage that's done to roads during that brief period takes weeks or months to repair.
Helm says he doesn't expect these small setbacks to affect the predictions that North Dakota will reach 850,000 barrels of oil production daily sometime in 2014. And the zombie craze has caught the attention of Fargo police. A group that mimics zombie hunters from the video game Resident Evil want to carry airsoft guns in tomorrow's St. Patrick's Day parade in downtown Fargo. But Lieutenant Jess Guza says that would be a violation of a city ordinance.
Airsoft guns are a tamed-down version of a BB gun, but the city ordinance for dangerous weapon and firearms defined includes anything that projects a projectile with a spring or compressed air, and so airsoft weapons fit that.
Jen Hoy doesn't like the idea either. She's part of a separate group that's involved in the zombie pub crawl, which is also planning to march in the parade.
We're just interested in strictly people looking like the undead, walking around with their arms outstretched, moaning for brains and beer.
Tomorrow's parade starts at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Over 75 floats, families, and marchers have already signed up for the trek down Broadway. For
Prairie, a lot of fun, Todd.
Brains and beer. What a better afternoon than that, right?
Well, I think I couldn't understand the airsoft guns thing because obviously, they need a weapon. Their arms fall off if they try to, you know, really tangle with somebody. Well, thanks for that, Dave Breitner. So now we're going to go to Bismarck, where Dave Thompson, Prairie Public News Director, is poised in front of his microphone because we've actually had some news today, Dave.
And we have had some news today for sure in terms of what has happened in the state Senate regarding abortion bills. Now, we have two abortion bills that passed this afternoon, and they passed fairly narrow margin, but each of them got at least 27 votes. One would say that you cannot have an abortion for sex selection of the potential child or when a fetus has a genetic abnormality. That passed 27-15. A second bill would ban abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy. It's called the heartbeat bill. And about 6 weeks is when a fetal heartbeat can be detected. Now, the proponents, the supporters of the bill, argue that when the Supreme Court came down with the Roe v. Wade decision, it said that the states could pass law to protect what they call potential life. And they say that the definition of potential life has changed quite a bit in the 40 years, and now you've got a heartbeat, and that is potential life. Well, groups like the Center for Reproductive Rights are in saying this is the most restrictive abortion law in the country. And they say to them it's very clear that Roe v. Wade talked about viability of the fetus. So this could set up the state challenging Roe v. Wade directly and possibly Casey versus Planned Parenthood.
Well, this is like one step further than South Dakota went, I take it.
Yeah, that's right. As a matter of fact, when the Center for Reproductive Rights say this bill about the heartbeat bill may be the most restrictive abortion bill in the country. There was a state that passed one which banned it at 12 weeks, and I think Arizona banned it at 20 weeks, but North Dakota has gone to 6 weeks.
Well, this would almost, well, it would certainly result in a lawsuit.
I would think that's potentially part of the reason why these are being brought up. Supporters of the measure have told several of us who are reporting on it that one of the reasons why they're bringing that up is to have a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade and saying, okay, here is modern, and have them relook at Roe v. Wade, possibly.
Well, Heidi just reminded us of the fiscal note process in the North Dakota legislature.
That is correct.
So is there a fiscal note tied to this bill?
On one of them, there is $1 million for defending it. And there are some fiscal notes on some bills that are still pending in the House. One would be a constitutional amendment that would not be voted on until 2014, and that would be a personhood bill, basically saying that life begins at the moment of conception. Well, if that goes to the Supreme Court, there's going to have to be some money for that too. So there are some fiscal notes that are being floated around here.
And how about the opponents? What were their voices like?
The opponents basically have got the arguments that this is a decision between the woman and her doctor and her God, so that the legislature should not interject itself into these type of decisions.
Well, we'll see.
One more point, Doug, about the one bill that also bans sex elections.
Yes.
The opponents say there's no evidence that happens in the United States. It has happened apparently in China and in some other foreign countries, but not in the United States. So they say that this is not necessary. Again, you can argue that semantic too.
There is also another big story out of the higher ed, debacle.
Mm-hmm. If you're talking about the chancellor and the Board of Higher Education, there was an investigation into some of the allegations brought up by the student board member about violations of open meetings law and violations of board policy. The board's attorney took a look at it, has drafted and posted a 200-page report on the Board of Higher Education website, and she came to the conclusion that there was one inadvertent violation of the open meetings law that can be cured fairly quickly. The rest of it, there's no evidence of any kind of going around policy or not including people or threatening to fire presidents. But there is such a disconnect between legislators and the board on this whole situation. There are a few legislators who are saying privately today that they think it might be a bit of a whitewash. I'm just passing it along as to what some of them are saying. They said that to make sure you did it right and to make sure that you have the perception that you did it right, the board should have hired outside counsel to do the investigation instead of doing it in-house.
It is an internal review, and that I have heard that criticism on this side of the state as well.
Absolutely.
Now, there was something else, though, that happened. The House voted
today
to change governance.
Exactly. Now, this has happened before. The House Majority Leader Al Carlson has proposed this type of governance change before. He would replace the Board of Higher Education with a Department of Higher Education and have a chancellor in control that would be appointed by the governor. He said that, you know, because you've got the appointment, there's more of a line of accountability. And he said that the university system is about a $3 billion enterprise. And in his words, nobody has control over it. And what you have is a volunteer board of 8 members who work part-time. So he wanted more direct accountability. And while he's proposed this 2 years ago in a different form, where he would have created a Department of Education, which would run from K through 16 or K through 20. That did not pass. This one did pass the House and will be considered by the Senate.
Well, that kind of approach does put a higher political component in the governance of the higher education institutions, and that could have some accreditation ramifications.
There's some accreditation ramifications, and you go back in your history to 1938 with then-Governor Bill Langer, who at the time removed some professors from NDSU who he didn't like, and that's when the board was created by a vote of the people saying the board will insulate the university system from politics. So yeah, there are some ramifications for this entire thing.
My eyebrows arched when I saw money for North Dakota college students in a Senate concurrent resolution. $450 million would be deposited into a fund, and the earnings then would be used for scholarships for students who meet eligibility requirements. Now, that's a pretty fair chunk of money, just the earnings off that.
It's a pretty fair chunk of money, but here is some breaking news, too. The Senate has reversed itself and killed the bill now.
Oh, really? That is
so
news.
So that is gone.
Okay.
And we will have a story this afternoon on that, too. It was brought back up for reconsideration, and the majority said, well, we're probably a little bit premature because the money would come from the interest on the legacy fund,
mm-hmm.
money that's being deposited from oil taxes that's going to sit in the legacy fund and be used. You can use it after 2017.
Well, this would have been approved in the 2014 general election, so there would have
that's
been a
right.
year or so. But nevertheless, that's, well, news marches on.
It does, and they're talking about bringing it back up in the next legislative session.
Unemployment insurance was in front of the House, apparently.
It has to go with the idea of locked-out workers being eligible for unemployment insurance. Everybody considered that the state law said that locked-out workers were not eligible. But along came the American Crystal strike, and the American Crystal Union members took the state to court to collect on that. A lower court said, no, you're not eligible. The Supreme Court, in a 3-2 ruling, reversed that and saying the language is ambiguous in terms of who is eligible or what, and the workers should get their unemployment benefits. Now the legislature wants to go back and quote, clarify the law, end quote, and they would say that locked-out workers are not eligible to do that. That's passed the Senate, and the arguments in the Senate, the proponents said we want to clarify the law because we believe the original intent was not to allow locked-out workers to get this, and we really don't want to get involved in labor disputes. But opponents said, you know, these people are locked out by their own, not by their own volition, but by the volition of the company. People like the American Crystal Sugar Workers say they would have continued to work while negotiations went on, even though they rejected the contract offer.
Mm-hmm. And the lawyers for American Crystal are actually asking the North Dakota Supreme Court to reconsider its decision to that close decision to grant those unemployment benefits to locked out workers, sort of appealing for an appeal from the Supreme
Court. Exactly,
but
that's the way you have to do it. Uh-huh. If you don't like the decision of the Supreme Court, you can ask for a rehearing. And those haven't been granted very often, let's be honest.
There was a drone bill discussed. Bring us up to date on that.
That's another breaking news story. This is Friday afternoon.
Of course.
You know, everything's coming up on Friday afternoon. The state Senate has killed the drone bill. What the drone bill would have done was to require a law enforcement agency to get a search warrant before you flew a drone over somebody's private land or somebody's private residence. It passed the House, and the sponsor, Representative Becker from Bismarck, basically said this is part of your Fourth Amendment rights against illegal search and seizure. However, the opponents who had their day in the Senate said, it's a new technology. We've got the potential for UND to do some research on UAVs. Let's not go down the road yet. This bill is premature. And the Senate agreed.
Well, and there's kind of a logic thing here. I mean, how is a drone more intrusive than an airplane?
That was an argument that was used on the Senate floor, by the way.
Okay.
Is how does a drone more intrusive than an airplane? The proponents of the bill came back and said drones are very small. You know, that somebody had a drone that was maybe 7 inches long. So mm-hmm. you're talking about very, very limited intrusiveness in terms of the physicality of the drone, but intrusiveness nonetheless because you are able to surveil.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, the DUI bill continues to ricochet around the Capitol.
There are two DUI bills, as a matter of fact, Doug. One is in the House. It passed the Senate. One's in the Senate. It passed the House. Now, Senate bill was before a House committee. Now, it was changed dramatically. And one of the major things that the sponsors wanted was to have mandatory jail time for a first-time DUI offender. The bill, as it came out of the Senate, said no, unless the offender blows a .18 on a breathalyzer. So there is no mandatory minimum in terms of sentences. The feeling by the Senate committee and the Senate when they passed the bill was that you've got other ways to go around this. The 24/7 program, putting bracelets on people, and these bracelets are very high-tech things, about $5,000 a piece, that can detect if somebody's been drinking. And the idea is to try to prevent people from drinking rather than punish people. The opponents and the sponsors of the original bill said, yeah, we want to deter too, but we want to deter by holding out this punishment thing out there, saying if you do this, you will be punished. Well, Senator Armstrong from Dickinson, who is a defense attorney, came back to the committee in the House and said, if you put a mandatory minimum jail time, I won't plead out a DUI anymore. I'll take them to court, because what have you got to lose at that point? And he said that would clog the court system.
Yeah, it would. So there are strong opinions on both sides yet.
Yeah, and I think two bills are going to be melded into one eventually here. And where it goes from there, your guess is as good as mine.
Well, we'll probably be talking about this on another Friday.
I would think so.
All right. Well, thank you, Dave
Thompson.
Prairie Public News Director joins us from Bismarck every Friday to bring us up to date on what's been happening at the Capitol. And we're going to go to the movies with Matt O'Lean. He's, following Disney to Oz next.
Prairie Public is launching a new multimedia project about bullying among kids in North Dakota. But the project needs a name. If you've got an idea, send it to info@prairiepublic.org by email. Whoever comes up with the winner will receive a $25 gift certificate. And don't forget to listen for programming from, well, it could be Project Bully, but that's already taken. Could be the Anti-Bully Project. Now, that one's already taken.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public, and it's Friday, so we go to the movies with our movie reviewer, Matt O'Lean. And you went to another, kind of the recent addition in the franchise we call Oz.
Yes, and it needs a good addition. As we discussed before we went on the air here, Doug, Return to Oz was a disaster.
I saw that in the 80s. That was awful.
The Wiz never really, with Michael Jackson and Diana Ross, it was okay, but not great. And it's hard to recapture the magic of a film that is basically part of our culture, like Wizard of Oz. I mean, it's almost like we come out of the womb knowing these songs. And it's a phenomenal success that actually was a film. And you forget that people actually made this film. It's so familiar to us that it's hard to step into those shoes or out of that shadow.
And intriguing that Disney buys it up.
Disney's buying up all kinds of stuff right now. So I think there's going to be a spinoff from this. Now, this film, Oz the Great and Powerful, takes us back to how the wizard, played by Frank Morgan in the original, got to Oz. Just like in the original, the film starts out in 4:3 ratio in black and white scenes with him back in Kansas. And I like these scenes a lot. He's at a carnival. He's doing magic. He's obviously a con man. And through a series of events, he ends up in Oz. And then, of course, it turns to color and widescreen, just like with the original. What's funny was when I was a kid, Doug, before we had a color TV set, I didn't know Oz was in color. So, all of a sudden, Judy is in Oz and Dorothy, Judy. And you're like, oh, this is in color. This is great. What an ingenious idea. But the same thing happens here. I like the early scenes. Now, once he gets in Oz, the film takes a while to get going. It really... You're kind of waiting for some action. He meets Mila Kunis, who's one of the witches. We're not going to say if she ends up wicked or not. She's fantastically beautiful with the CGI, colorful background, her enormous eyes. Mila Kunis is just a huge rising star right now, and she's very good in her role. But a lot happens. She thinks he's the savior. He's come to be the king because he has the same name as the land he's in, Oz. That's his nickname. And then, of course, we meet the other witches eventually. Rachel Weisz plays her sister. Again, we don't know if she's going to turn wicked. And eventually, Michelle Williams as Glinda, the good. So we can assume that she's good, but we're not sure. So those are the three he meets, and he needs to become king. He needs to vanquish the one that's wicked, and that's the trick, is finding out which of those three is really the wicked one that has designs on ousting him and enslaving the people of Oz, and that's where it goes. Now, eventually the film picks up, and it picks up when he meets this monkey who can talk, who he frees, and that's voiced by Zach Braff. It also picks up when he meets a little plate girl named China Girl that he glues back together, and she is voiced by an actress who we see in the black and white scene. So just like with the 39 version, Doug, we see Zach Braff in the black and white scenes, and then he comes back as the voice of the monkey. We see the little girl in the black and white scenes, you know, just like Ray Bolger was a farmhand in the black and white scenes in the 39 version, and then we see him as the Scarecrow. So I like that they did that. This China Girl CGI character is so charming. And he takes care of her, James Franco does. So those are almost the best parts of the film, are these CGI characters they come up with. Franco, the reviews on this film are all over the place. I liked it a little better than I thought I was going to like it. Now, maybe that's because my kids were with me, but I went in, some of the reviews are horrible, some are good. I thought it was a little better than I thought it was going to be, and actually it kind of captured my imagination after about an hour. So I would give it a fairly decent tentative thumbs up. The CGI is a little over the top. It has kind of that What Dreams May Come feel to it, like you're in some kind of weird nether life, and it's a little too much, a little too cartoonish. That wasn't my favorite part of it. The witches don't have a lot to do, although once the wicked part comes out, there's more to do for that actress. Michelle Williams just basically smiles and looks nice. Franco was thought to be miscast by some because he was not attached to this film. Robert Downey was attached to this film first. I would have loved to have seen his take on The Wizard. Then Johnny Depp was attached to it. I think Johnny would have taken us into Bizarro Land like he does with a lot of his roles. Franco initially seems miscast. After about 40 minutes, I'm okay with him in the role. I think he does pretty good. Hard to see James Franco playing a period piece because he's so kind of a modern actor. But I think eventually I would call him passable in the role. What's fascinating about the CGI, Doug, is all of this money that they can spend to make this look good. And you know what? Oz looks better in the 1939 version. It's unbelievable what the craftsmen, the technicians, and the artists were able to do at MGM in 1939 to make Oz look like this fairy tale land. I prefer the Oz of 1939 to 2013, which is an unbelievable comment on how far we've come, and yet you still can't quite recapture that magic.
Matt, I was just thinking of that when you were talking about how you didn't know that Oz went to color when, you know, because we watched
CBS every year.
We watched it in black and white on TV until, of course, color TVs were ubiquitous. And I can only imagine the way the audience initially reacted in that theater in 1939 when they saw what was a very standard black and white picture go to Technicolor.
Right.
It must have been amazing.
Yeah. I can't even imagine what it would have been like. Now, there had been Technicolor films up to that point,
but
it's a surprise that we're going to the Technicolor.
Yeah.
While Franco is good in the film, I want to tell people this is not a musical, not like the original. There are no songs. And as good as Franco tries, he's very eager. He tries his best. There's something, again, about Judy Garland as Dorothy. It's a phenomenal performance that we just kind of assume she can do with ease. But how many people can do what she did, be charming, be this naive, innocent girl, and be able to have the voice that she had? So, again, it's very hard to recapture the magic. But overall, I liked it. But it's not in the league of a 39 film. However, it made $80 million. So I think we're going to have another sequel after this, or a prequel really to Before Dorothy Gets to Kansas. So I think kids will like it. Any kid under five, there's a couple scary scenes. There are flying monkeys again, which terrified a whole generation of children with the first film. Overall, I liked it. Not a great film, not bad, somewhere in the middle.
All right. Well, let's try to stump you with a little trivia question here. And invite our listeners to participate, too, if you'd like to email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. We would entertain your difficult movie trivia question for Matt Olien. Here's your question. Which was the last feature film of screen legend Paul Newman, which was also the highest-grossing movie of his career?
Cars.
Well done. 2006. And
the highest grossing film of Ball's career. Yeah, it probably would be.
Yeah.
I would say based on inflation, it would still be Butch Cassidy. Wow. Probably, but yeah, Cars.
Well, we picked your brain, and by golly, we found the answer. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 15th. As cars became more in vogue, cities started to develop traffic laws. On this date in 1940, residents of Bismarck were patting themselves on the back for changes they made to regulate traffic. A report done by the Bismarck Safety and Courtesy Committee came out around this time stating that 80% of traffic accidents that occurred in the city were due to excessive speed, especially under unfavorable weather and light conditions. The report examined traffic accidents from 1939 and the first 2 months of 1940, comparing them with incidents in 1938. There were 221 accidents in 1938, but only 150 over the next 14 months. The Safety and Courtesy Committee attributed this change to the rigid enforcement of traffic laws by the police and the courts. This included Police Magistrate Oglerson's policy of fining speeders $1 for every mile per hour over the speed limit. The chief of police credited the committee as well, pointing out that in 1938, many accidents had occurred around business areas. Since then, the committee had been formed, and their efforts helped ease that concentration of accidents. The council stated, "There is no excuse for drivers not knowing what the traffic laws are. If they are in doubt, they can ascertain restrictions by calling the police department or the state highway patrol." Of course, the Safety and Courtesy Committee couldn't take into account what sort of road rage might rock the streets. A man making a left turn accidentally brushed up against a pedestrian. Understandably upset, the pedestrian hurled a hammer through the back window of the car when it failed to stop. The hammer did the trick. The driver got out of the car, and a fistfight ensued. Excessive speeds in poor conditions may have been the greatest danger on the road, but there's no denying the dangers of a side-swiping car or a flying hammer. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Sarah Walker. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Well, Main Street on Friday just flew by, but we'll regroup and do this again Monday through Friday next week. And Ashley Thornburg joins me with a little, well, tease, if you will, about what she's got on her plate.
I do. Coming up on Monday, a new exhibition at UND. It documents moral courage and specifically people risking their lives in the face of atrocity to save would-be victims of genocide. I'll talk with UND associate law professor and former genocide prosecutor Gregory Gordon. And he will talk about what went into this exhibition and, of course, some of his work in the past as well.
Well, you remember Chris Burke. He's the actor who played Corky on Life Goes On. Wasn't one of my favorite series. But he
but
and the DeMasi brothers have produced a DVD for kids called Forever Friends. And as it turns out, Joseph DeMasi lives in Valley City, so we'll be exploring that story. Tom Ezern has this week's Plainsfolk column, or I should say next week's Why Should We Care? And, of course, we'll have Merrill Pepcorn with a Dakota Datebook. And in the meantime, lots of stuff going on this weekend. I mentioned St. Patrick's Day Parade in Fargo tomorrow, where the high will
be
15
lots
degrees.
Lots of snow to trudge through this year. A little different from last year.
Yeah, it's coming down pretty hard right now. We're hoping it lets up a bit so that the roads can get plowed. But, well, it's winter. It's March anyway. We'll get out of this. In the meantime, you have a great weekend.